Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to book 12. Oh man, how have I just suddenly forgotten? Is it book 12? I need to double check. Yes. Okay. Book 12, chapter 14. Sorry about that. When Princess Mary heard from Nicholas that her brother was with the Rostovs at Yaroslavl, she at once prepared to go there in spite of her aunt's efforts to dissuade her, and not merely to go herself, but to take her nephew with her. Whether it were easy or difficult, possible or impossible, she did not ask and did not want to know. It was her duty, not only to herself, to be near her brother, who was perhaps dying, but to do everything possible to take his son to him. And so she prepared to set off. That she had not heard from Prince Andrew himself, Princess Mary attributed to this his being too weak to write, or to his considering the long journey too hard and too dangerous for her and his son. In a few days Princess Mary was ready to start. Her equipages were the huge family coach in which she had travelled to Voronezh, a semi-open trap, and a baggage cart. With her travelled Mademoiselle Bourienne, little Nicholas and his tutor, her old nurse, three maids, Tikhon, and a young footman and courier her aunt had sent to accompany her. The usual route through Moscow could not be thought of, and the roundabout way Princess Mary was obliged to take through Lipetsk, Ryazan, Vladimir and Shuya was very long, and as post horses were not everywhere obtainable, very difficult, and near Ryazan, where the French were said to have shown themselves, was even dangerous. During this difficult journey, Mademoiselle Bourienne, de Sales and Princess Mary's servants were astonished at her energy and firmness of spirit. She went to bed later and rose earlier than any of them, and no difficulties daunted her. Thanks to her activity and energy, which infected her fellow travellers, they approached Yaroslavl by the end of the second week. The last days of her stay in Varenz had been the happiest of her life. Her love for Rostov no longer tormented or agitated her. It filled her whole soul, had become an integral part of herself, and she no longer struggled against it. Latterly she had become convinced that she loved and was beloved, though she never said this definitely to herself in words. She had become convinced of it at her last interview with Nicholas, when he had come to her to tell her that her brother was with the Rostovs. Not by a single word had Nicholas alluded to the fact that Prince Andrew's relations with Natasha might, if he recovered, be renewed, but Princess Mary saw by his face that he knew and thought of this. Yet in spite of that, his relation to her, considerate, delicate, and loving, not only remained unchanged, but it sometimes seemed to Princess Mary that he was even glad that the family connection between them allowed him to express his friendship more freely. She knew that she loved for the first and only time in her life, and felt that she was beloved and was happy in regard to it. But this happiness on one side of her spiritual nature did not prevent her feeling grief for her brother with full force. On the contrary, that spiritual tranquillity on the one side made it the more possible for her to give full play to her feeling for her brother. That feeling was so strong at the moment of leaving Varenz that those who saw her off, as they looked at her careworn, despairing face, felt sure she would fall ill on the journey. But the very difficulties and preoccupations of the journey, which she took so actively in hand, saved her for a while from her grief and gave her strength. As always happens when travelling, Princess Mary thought only of the journey itself, forgetting its object, but as she approached Yaroslavl, the thought of what might await her there, not after many days, but that very evening, again presented itself to her, and her agitation increased to its utmost limit. The courier who had been sent on in advance to find out where the Rostovs were staying in Yaroslavl, and in what condition Prince Andrew was, when he met the big coach just entering the town gates, was appalled by the terrible pallor of the princess's face that looked at him from the window. "I have found out everything, Your Excellency. The Rostovs are staying at the merchant Bronnikov's house in the square, not far from here, right above the Volga," said the courier. Princess Mary looked at him with frightened inquiry, not understanding why he did not reply to what she chiefly wanted to know. How was her brother? Mademoiselle Bourienne put that question for her. "How is the prince?" she asked. "His Excellency is staying in the same house with them." "Then he is alive," thought Princess Mary, and asked in a low voice, "How is he?" "The servants say he is still the same." What "still the same" might mean, Princess Mary did not ask, but with an unnoticed glance at little seven-year-old Nicholas, who was sitting in front of her looking with pleasure at the town, she bowed her head and did not raise it up again till the heavy coach, rumbling, shaking, and swaying, came to a stop. The carriage steps clattered as they were let down. The carriage door opened. On the left there was water, a great river, and on the right a porch. There were people at the entrance, servants, and a rosy girl with a large plait of black hair, smiling, as it seemed, to Princess Mary in an unpleasantly affected way. This was Sonya. Princess Mary ran up the steps. This way," said the girl, with the same artificial smile, and the princess found herself in the hall, facing an elderly woman of Oriental type, who came rapidly to meet her with a look of emotion. This was the Countess. She embraced Princess Mary and kissed her. "Mon enfant," she muttered, "je vous aime et vous connais depuis longtemps," which means, "My child, I love you and have known you a long time." Despite her excitement, Princess Mary realized that this was the Countess and that it was necessary to say something to her. Hardly knowing how she did it, she contrived to utter a few polite French phrases in the same tone as those that had been addressed to her, and asked, "How is he?" "The doctor says that he is not in danger," said the Countess, but as she spoke she raised her eyes with a sigh, and her gesture conveyed a contradiction of her words. "Where is he? Can I see him? Can I?" asked the Princess. "One moment, Princess, one moment, my dear. Is this his son?" said the Countess, turning to little Nicholas, who was coming in with de Sales. "There will be room for everybody. This is a big house. Oh, what a lovely boy." The Countess took Princess Mary into the drawing room where Sonya was talking to Mademoiselle Bourienne. The Countess caressed the boy, and the old Count came in and welcomed the Princess. He had changed very much since Princess Mary had last seen him. Then he had been a brisk, cheerful, self-assured old man. Now he seemed a pitiful, bewildered person. While talking to Princess Mary, he continually looked around, as if asking everyone whether he was doing the right thing. After the destruction of Moscow and of his property, thrown out of his accustomed groove, he seemed to have lost the sense of his own significance and to feel that there was no longer a place for him in life. In spite of her one desire to see her brother as soon as possible, and her vexation that at that moment, when all she wanted was to see him, they should be trying to entertain her and pretending to admire her nephew, the princess noticed all that was going on around her and felt the necessity of submitting for a time to this new order of things which she had entered. She knew it to be necessary, and though it was hard for her, she was not vexed with these people. "This is my niece," said the Count, introducing Sonya. "You don't know her, princess." Princess Mary turned to Sonya, and trying to stifle the hostile feeling that arose in her towards the girl, she kissed her. But she felt oppressed by the fact that the mood of everyone around her was so far from what it was in her own heart. "Where is he?" she asked again, addressing them all. "He is downstairs. Natasha is with him," answered Sonya, flushing. "We have sent to ask. I think you must be tired, princess." Tears of vexation showed themselves in Princess Mary's eyes. She turned away and was about to ask the Countess again how to go to him when light, impetuous, and seemingly buoyant steps were heard at the door. The princess looked around and saw Natasha coming in, almost running. That Natasha, whom she had liked so little at their meeting in Moscow long since, but hardly had the princess looked at Natasha's face before she realized that here was a real comrade in her grief and consequently a friend. She ran to meet her, embraced her, and began to cry on her shoulder. As soon as Natasha, sitting at the head of Prince Andrew's bed, heard of Princess Mary's arrival, she softly left his room and hastened to her with those swift steps that had sounded buoyant to Princess Mary. There was only one expression on her agitated face when she ran into the drawing room, that of love, boundless love for him, for her, and for all that was near to the man she loved, and of pity, suffering for others, and passionate desires to give herself entirely to helping them. It was plain that at that moment there was in Natasha's heart no thought of herself or of her own relations with Prince Andrew. Princess Mary, with her acute sensibility, understood all this at the first glance at Natasha's face and wept on her shoulder with sorrowful pleasure. "Come in, come to him, Mary," said Natasha, leading her into the other room. Princess Mary raised her head, dried her eyes, and turned to Natasha. She felt that from her she would be able to understand and learn everything. "How?" she began her question, but stopped short. She felt that it was impossible to ask or to answer in words. Natasha's face and eyes would have to tell her all more clearly and profoundly. Natasha was gazing at her, but seemed afraid and in doubt whether to say all she knew or not. She seemed to feel that before those luminous eyes which penetrated into the very depths of her heart, it was impossible not to tell the whole truth which she saw. And suddenly Natasha's lips twitched, ugly wrinkles gathered round her mouth, and covering her face with her hands, she burst into sobs. Princess Mary understood, but she still hoped and asked in words she herself did not trust, "But how is his wound? What is his general condition?" You will see," was all Natasha could say. They sat a little while downstairs near his room till they had left off crying and were able to go to him with calm faces. "How has his whole illness gone? Is it a long time since he grew worse? When did this happen?" Princess Mary inquired. Natasha told her that at first there had been danger from his feverish condition and the pain he suffered, but at Troitska that he had passed, and the doctor had only been afraid of gangrene. The danger had also passed. When they reached Yaroslavl, the wound had begun to fester. Natasha knew all about such things as festering, and the doctor had said that the festering might take a normal course. Then a fever set in, but the doctor had said the fever was not very serious. "But 2 days ago this happened suddenly," said Natasha, struggling with her sobs. "I don't know why, but you will see what he is like." "Is he weaker, thinner?" asked the princess. "No, it's not that, but worse, you will see. Oh, Mary, he is too good. He cannot live because..." Dot, dot, dot. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Mary has rushed to see her brother. We want to see how her brother Andre is doing, but the old Tolstoy cliffhanger. Damn. That's the last confusing line. That last line was, I don't know what to make of that. "He's not weaker or thinner." It was, "No, not that. It's worse than that," says Natasha. "You'll see. He's too good. He can't live because..." So something worse has happened, which means he's good, but he can't live. Very confusing little last thing. I actually can't wait to see what that means. Chattel Valster said, "Ending with such a cliffhanger without spoiling it, who couldn't wait a day and already read the next chapter?" I am actually very tempted to read ahead, but I will not. Mostly because it's quite late at night at the moment for me. But yeah, absolutely, what a cliffhanger. Chattel Valster also said, "After arriving at the house, Sonia welcomes them and Maya, and it seems that she smiles unpleasantly and falsely. Could this be a true observation? And if not, why would it seem unpleasant and false to Maya?" Yeah, Maya really doesn't seem to like a lot of people, does she? She makes these impulse decisions that she just dislikes this person and that person. It's not the first, it's not even the second or third time we've seen her do this. And the other thing Shadow Velsta asked is, during the journey to Andre, Maya's servants are astonished by her firmness of spirit and energy. Did this surprise you? And if not, how can it be that the servants are surprised by it? Well, I don't think Maya is a lazy person. I don't think she's slow. I think she's actually quite handy and quite proactive. So that didn't strike me as weird. You know, Who Was Once Delight said, I think it is true that Sonya genuinely loved Nikolai, and she is losing him to Maya. Sonya must realize that the turn Andre is taking spells that out. Plus, there's the fact that Nikolai seems to have accepted her release of him without protest. If she could smile genuinely through that, she'd be a better woman than I am. Well, yeah, okay, then I actually hadn't even thought of that. Yeah, Sonya and Maya are both in love with the same guy. That would explain the fake smile. I think Sonya is bluffing a little bit, isn't she? She's saying, Nikolai, you're free to do whatever you want, knowing that that is A, going to reflect really well on her, and also knowing B, that most likely Maya and Nikolai won't be able to end up together because Natasha will get in with Andre first. Who Was Once Delight continued to say, I mentioned to my husband how touching and funny I found the scene where Natasha and Maya essentially communicate everything necessary through crying. Maya sees Natasha's anxious face, and the sensitive princess Maya understood all, and with grieving pleasure wept on her shoulder. And seeing the question of how Andre is doing in Maya's eyes, Natasha's lips suddenly trembled, ugly wrinkles formed around her mouth, and bursting into sobs, she covered her face with her hands. He pointed out how similar this scene is really to a scene really early in the book, back when Natasha and Sonya were basically children, besotted with Nikolai and Boris, who have been enlisted in the coming war. Sonya goes missing from a party, Natasha goes to find her, and does find her sobbing on her nurse's bed. It says, Natasha, spreading her big mouth and looking perfectly ugly, started howling like a baby, not knowing why, only because Sonya was crying. It's interesting to see how Natasha's emotions and understanding have matured with her becoming, without her becoming any less sensitive. Wow, what a great comment by Who Was Once Delight, and a cool observation by Who Was Once Delight's husband. Very, very awesome. Chattel Velster said, that's a really interesting parallel. It makes you realize how far she has come. De Fleury said, I love that comrades in grief concept. Everyone else was very nice, but Natasha was trustworthy because she was the only one who behaved appropriately. Yeah, it was really frustrating, wasn't it, when Mary first got to the house and was just asking after him, where's Andre, and just no one would tell her, you know, and it was starting to sort of annoy her. It was starting to annoy me a bit, like, the woman's travelled to see her dying brother. Lead the way. Like, what's all these pleasantries? Show her. I actually don't understand why they didn't. Puffle Huffy says, it was asked before, but I must ask again, why on earth is Mademoiselle Boreen still with them? Huh. Yeah, good question. I think we spoke about that earlier, but yeah, we still don't really know why. De Fleury said, duh, I just realize now why Mary thinks Sonya is all fake. I thought it was just her standard game face, in the perpetual role as poor little cousin who must be helpful and cheerful all the time. Yeah. Well, now it's obvious, isn't it? They're both after the same man. De Fleury said, war has made the parents suddenly turn old. Yeah, right? Especially old man Rostov, to see him just looking around at the rest of the people in the room as if, like, not even knowing what to do in any situation. He was just like baffled by the world. Kind of sad. Kind of just become a useless old man. Fleury also said, "I read ahead. I couldn't stand it how this chapter ended." Yeah, again, Tolstoy is actually at danger of overusing the cliffhanger. And I as bad as this is to criticize Tolstoy, I don't think he uses the cliffhanger very tastefully. He kind of uses it almost like, it's almost like a cheap trick, a cheap shot. You feel a bit cheated when he does it, like he's kind of played you as a reader. There's a good way to do a cliffhanger, and there's a kind of too in your face way. Like, this whole chapter was about Mary finding out how Andre is and seeing them reunited, and you read the whole chapter wanting that to happen right from the very first word of the chapter, and he knew that, and then just as it was about to happen, like, it literally ended with dot dot dot. Kind of feels like he knows he's got you on the line, and he's almost like playing with the audience a little bit too much at that point. Alright, that's going to do us for today's podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.